Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Tortoise. Hello, welcome to Trendy from Tortoise. I'm John Curtis.
And I'm Rachel Wolfe. Speculation has gripped Westminster for weeks about the timing of the next election. Rishi Sunak has said he expects to call one in the second half of this year. Jeremy Hunt has hinted that it will be in October, or has he? Either way, we're now into the long campaign.
So we thought that this week on Trendy, we'd look at election campaigns. How have they changed over the years? Who pays for them? What difference, if any, do they make? And does all that talk about social media really matter? Now, I have to say, in order for us to talk about this subject, we have been joined by a real expert, Kate Domett, who is Professor of Digital Politics at the University of Sheffield. I guess, Kate, the first obvious question to ask, which many listeners might have in their minds, is what does a Professor of Digital Politics do? I have to say, when I was applying for university jobs, I don't think I ever saw that job description.
Well, thank you ever so much for having me on. It's a real pleasure to be here. So this is the trouble of when they let you make up your own job title. I wanted to kind of differentiate the fact that rather than just being a professor of politics, that my real focus is on digital technology and the implications it has for politics.
Ah, so you're going to tell us all about that social media and targeting and maybe even AI stuff at this election.
I will do my best.
I guess, first of all, we should ask the question as to whether campaigns matter at all. I mean, if you go back to the early studies of British sociology of the 1950s and 1960s, they came to a pretty poor conclusion about campaigns. They said two things. One is campaigns are pretty rotten at actually uncovering what are the crucial issues facing the country, and we don't really end up with a debate that gives us that much idea about what are the real options facing us. That was conclusion number one. And conclusion number two, and perhaps it's merciful given the characterization of the campaigns, is that they didn't really make any difference. The result at the end of the election was guessable from the result at the beginning. Most voters didn't change their minds. Oh, and all those efforts of constituency candidates knocking on people's doors, it was all a waste of time. Is that a picture that you recognise now, Kate, or not?
I think you have to kind of think of this at two levels. You know, obviously, there's kind of broad trends and big national sweeps, and it's pretty hard to turn around public opinion when you're kind of 20 points behind in the polls. But there is some research that shows that at the kind of local level and local constituencies, you can have kind of an impact on particularly turnout and actually getting your voters out to cast their ballot. And in really tight campaigns, that can make a difference. But certainly, you're not going to radically change people's minds.
OK, so you've already introduced for us a crucial distinction between the national campaign that we see on our televisions, we see on these days on social media, etc., and the local campaign by individual candidates, which you're saying, yeah. A lot of research, particularly done by Ron Johnson, who again was once at your institution, has also argued that local campaigns matter. Indeed, I well remember reading a wonderful book called The Battle of Barons Court. I don't know whether you've ever read it or not. It was a study by a couple of political scientists of what was then a very marginal seat in what we now call the London Borough of Hammersmith. And one of them was embedded in the Labour campaign, and the other one was embedded in the Conservative campaign. And they had access to all their canvassing data, et cetera, et cetera. And they essentially came to the conclusion, well, yeah, sure, at the end of the day, the local campaign didn't make any difference. But that was because the campaign on one side was matched for effectiveness by the campaign on the other side. So the net effect was zero, but actually both sides had managed to get their voters out. But of course, at the moment, given the state of the opinion polls, i.e. the Conservatives at the moment about 20 points behind, there's a lot of interest and speculation about whether or not the campaign between now and polling day could actually make a difference. And so it's perhaps therefore worth looking at the more recent record. And in a sense, we can divide this into two things. We can talk about, well, do the polls necessarily narrow between now and when the election gets called? So we're about, at the moment, about 8 months out from polling day, probably. And then does the election campaign itself make a difference? So I've had the pleasurable task of going through the polls for all the recent elections. And, you know, you come to the conclusion that the assumption that there seems to be out there that actually, you know, there are the polls always narrow, the lead always gets closer during election campaigns. Well, the answer is sometimes it does and sometimes it doesn't. If we take the long campaign, for example, in full 5-year parliaments, well, yep, it's true, both before in the run-up to the 2015 election and the run-up to the 2010 election, the lead of the party that was ahead dropped quite substantially between 2009 and 2010. But before the 1997 election, actually, in the months leading up to the election being called, Labour's lead, already very extensive, got even bigger, please note. And before the 92 election, actually nothing happened in the 8 months running up to the 92 election. As for the campaigns themselves, well, the truth is, by my reckoning, yes, of the last 8 or 9 elections, there are 4 in which the lead has narrowed, 1 in which it didn't make any difference, and 3 where, in fact, the lead widened during the election campaign, so far as Conservative Labour is concerned. So the honest truth is, I think history certainly suggests that, yes, contrary to the picture of the 50s and 60s, we do get movements during campaigns, though not always, but the direction of the movement is not necessarily one whereby it's automatically the polls narrowing or indeed of the polls widening. And to that extent, at least, what happens between now and the election this time around is perhaps dependent on the quality of the campaigning.
John just talked about the quality of the campaigning, and you spoke earlier about local turnout and local campaigning having an impact. But how big a scale are we talking about? Because I think one of the things that people love to discuss in political campaigns is money and donors and how much spending in a campaign shifts what's going on. If we take our kind of putative 20-point lead and we look at the impact of huge amounts of money on the one hand, and exceptionally brilliant national campaigning, and then exceptionally brilliant local campaigning, how much of a difference is each of these plausibly going to make?
The first thing to make really clear is the difference between evidence that we have on mobilisation effects, so actually getting people to turn out to vote, and evidence that we have on persuasion effects, which is, are you actually kind of able to convince someone to change their mind? And it's really hard to study this because actually studying real-time election campaigns is a real challenge. But the kind of studies that we have show that the effects where they're noticeable tend to be around mobilisation. And there have been some recent studies that have shown that turnout can be boosted by about 2-3%, for example, in using phone calls. There was one study in Sweden recently which found a 3.6% impact on canvassing, on getting people to turn out. So we're not talking kind of huge swings, but that's definitely not insignificant. The kind of evidence around that national persuasion is the effects just tend to be much smaller. So it's really kind of the mobilisation, you know, your capacity to actually get your voters out to cast their ballot for you. That's kind of where the difference can be made.
And it's worth saying, Kate, is it not, that so far as local campaigning at least is concerned, traditionally, it's been about mobilisation. I mean, party canvassers get told, knock on the door, see if you can find out whether these folk are sympathetic to us or not. And if not, say goodbye, don't try to argue with them, right? They're basically trying to collect information about who is sympathetic so that if on polling day they're able to mount an operation whereby they're able to take a record of who's been visiting the polling station and your sympathizers have not come out, you can go on the door in the evening and knocking out. This is kind of very, very traditional campaigning. It's just getting information about how people are likely to vote and getting your lot to the polling station and giving them a lift if necessary.
Yeah, that's exactly it. That's what most campaigning on the doorstep and kind of what's happening when someone comes and knocks on your door or puts a leaflet through. I think the real challenge for local campaigns is that whilst they know that they can have these impacts, if you've got a really poor message that just isn't resonating, that's coming from the National Party, or there isn't a kind of good reason being given by the national level politicians around why your party is appealing, it's really difficult for you to do anything about that at a local level unless you kind of really focus on your own attributes as a local candidate and your own kind of independent stances. So it can be really frustrating, I think, for a candidate whose party at a national level just really isn't popular.
Isn't there a crucial point that runs out of this, which is that, you know, Rachel started this bit of the conversation by talking about money, but that actually we should remember that a lot of the resource that parties have are people, members who give time, they give money because you're not allowed to pay them, etc., etc. And that actually traditional campaigning, at least, was not about money. It's about people who spend their own money helping you to get your vote out, and that we can exaggerate the extent to which, you know, campaign spending limits and how much money parties have actually matter.
A campaign isn't one thing. It's about making points of contact between a political party and the electorate. And you can do that in a whole variety of ways. Now, some of that is having activists go out and knock the door for you. But you can also use leaflets. You can use online campaigning. There are a kind of range of different points of contact that you can use to interface with people. And what we see is different parties pursue different strategies dependent on the resources that they have. So if we look at the spending from the Conservatives versus Labour, you know, Labour are doing a lot more leafleting, like printing, and then getting activists to go and deliver it. Whereas we see the Tories and the Liberal Democrats, they spend so much more of their money on paid leaflet delivery because they don't have those activists to be able to go and distribute that message for them. So the kind of dynamics of the party affect the kind of campaign that they end up running.
But Kate, can we say anything about the relative effectiveness of these things? So we've got everything from supposedly targeted social media all the way to people knocking on people's doors using their own shoe leather. Do we know anything about which of these activities are more likely to either mobilise, certainly more likely to mobilise people, let alone persuade people?
So in the kind of traditional studies, when you kind of compare things like the impact of doorstep canvassing compared to leafleting and phone calls, you know, doorstep canvassing is always the most effective in terms of driving turnout. Now, there have been a few studies of social media impact, and what they generally find is that the impact is really small. Now, there's one kind of quite famous study that's come out that was a big meta study looking at, I think it was 49 kind of different adverts that will run the US campaign, and that showed a 0.7% impact on vote choice. So really small impact, and it's not zero, so it is having an effect, but the effect isn't huge. And you know, when you're kind of thinking about those 2-3% up to 5% in some studies around mobilization effects of more traditional methods, I think, you know, we're comparing mobilization measures as opposed to vote choice, so it's important to remember that. But that is quite a small impact. And when you compare the kind of narrative of how we're all being manipulated on social media, the kind of evidence doesn't seem to be backing that up.
So if you were sitting in the campaign headquarters of one of the three major political parties in the next election, basically you'd be saying, spend your money on recruiting activists or paying people to deliver leaflets for you. Don't spend it on digital advertising.
I would be saying, you need to work out which voters you need to contact, and you need to be thinking about how you need to contact them. So I think social media is often talked about, you know, if you just run a social media campaign, you'll be able to win an election. That's where the battleground is. And that's not what it is. It's It's about thinking about how you utilize and deploy all of the different campaign media that you can employ to reach the target audiences that you need to reach. So it will depend on which demographics each party is after. If you're really trying to communicate with 18 to 24 year olds, running a social media campaign and being active on TikTok is probably the best strategy for you. But if you're trying to reach the general electorate, then actually you need to be door knocking, you need to be phone canvassing, you need to be leafleting, and you need to be on places like Facebook, which we know that demographic is evident. So I think it's about recognizing that no single media is going to win you an election, and that now parties really need to be using a whole range of tools to try and communicate with people, because making those contacts is so difficult. So we know people just don't answer the phone anymore. So, you know, that used to be really effective, but each of these avenues, it's becoming harder and harder for parties to make contact. So they're having to do more and more across different media.
And would your advice to an individual MP in the Conservative Party who's on, let's say, 12,000 person majority, not tiny, to be as anti-Sunak as you can and set yourself up as the most independent conceivable candidate, because that might be how you save your seat, or just look for another job or campaign locally, what would you say to them?
So I would really go on local record if you were an individual MP. I think you have to kind of focus on, you know, you delivering for the local area and try and create a reason to vote for you. I think that's the real challenge for the Conservatives at the moment, is there is a lack of a reason to continue supporting the party. Now, if you look at your local MP and go, do you know, actually, they have really delivered for my local area, they are making a difference, then you can try and make a claim on that. And we've kind of historically seen quite a lot of MPs develop local manifestos and really promote those to show that they're delivering, even if the national party isn't.
Yeah, research evidence certainly suggests that MPs can create a personal vote. Again, that's contrary to the research evidence of the 50s and 60s. But it also says probably if you can get 1,000 votes is probably the maximum you can get out of it. So the point is, if you might lose a seat by a 1 or 2%, it might just rescue you. But the problem that many Conservative MPs face at the moment is that unless things change, the tsunami of the party's national unpopularity just means that whatever that personal local position they have is just not going to be enough. You know, it's going to be a finger in the dike. It's not going to keep the water out. But there we go. Okay, we're trendy, Kate. So we try to think about long-term trends, and we thought quite a lot about the challenges facing the parties at present. But let's go back. You know, unfortunately, I'm old enough to remember and to witness political campaigning in the 1960s. And, you know, it was very much a question of some of the things we've been talking about, particularly at local level, people knocking on people's doors, delivering leaflets and all the rest of it. But at the same time, we also had a situation where actually what the parties did at national level was not particularly tightly regulated. So it was very tight regulation on what candidates could spend for their local campaigns. But national campaigns weren't that much regulated. Television, of course, had just become a significant phenomenon. Campaigns weren't reported in the 1950s, but from 1959 onwards, television started to report election campaigns, etc., etc. How much have things really changed in the last 30, 40 years? And, you know, to what extent is that picture I've just painted is of parties leafleting, focusing on mass media, etc., has that really changed in the era of the internet, data dredging, etc., etc.?
It's often presumed that the newer technologies are replacing and supplanting those existing methods, but it's really a case of they're kind of adding another string to the bow, right? It's not the case that social media is replacing leaflets. In fact, if you look at like 2019, we've gone through the spending returns and you can see that, you know, it's still leafleting, it's still door knocking.
Kate, can I just stop you there? Can I just ask, you went through the spending returns?
John,
how many pieces of paper were you going through?
Yes, it was a delightful project. We went through 5,770 invoices that were declared by political parties at the last election. We looked at every single one of them.
So this is the national spending, yeah?
Yeah, the national spending by parties, because we wanted to kind of find out at a granular level what is actually money being spent on. Is kind of new technology, you know, data analytics, micro-targeting, is that where money's going? And what we found is that, you know, those kind of newer forms of innovation account for only 19% of spending. The vast majority is on really long-standing campaign practice. It's door knocking, it's printing campaign material, it's putting adverts in newspapers. And I think that's a really useful way of thinking about, you know, we haven't seen this wholesale shift in what they're doing. It's just an evolution of practice as newer kind of technologies become integrated.
So, Kate, come on, reveal the secrets. What was the most interesting or maybe even dodgy invoice that you came across doing this wonderful research?
Do you know, it was quite fun, I have to say. The Boris Johnson boxing gloves particularly stick out in my mind.
How much did they cost?
Oh, goodness, I can't remember that, John. It was didn't quite go into retaining all of this information, but definitely did look at it.
So what we've discovered is that Boris Johnson did not have a pair of boxing gloves before the 2019 election campaign. Somebody had to go out and buy them for him, yes?
I don't remember the boxing gloves. What did he box?
I think it must have been a merchandise.
Must be a stunt.
Exactly. So there was a lot of flash mobs that were bought. Found a invoice that said the Labour Party paid for a bot builder online software, which I found pretty interesting. But I think the main things we found from that exercise was just how little transparency there actually is about some of this stuff. So I remember particularly one set of invoices from CTF, which are the big consultancy firm the Conservatives were using.
Oh, Crosby Textor, whatever they're called. Yeah,
the Crosby Textor Foundation, indeed. Yeah. And the party spent, I think it was near 1.7 million with them at the last election. And the invoices just said for research. So we have no idea what they were doing in terms of for research. You know, there's kind of anecdotal evidence they were placing adverts on Facebook for the party, you know, doing polling, doing message testing. But we don't really know because of the lack of transparency in those invoices.
I wonder if we should move on to, as it were, one of the things that's going to be different about the 2024 campaign, which is the availability of artificial intelligence. There has been an awful lot of discussion about whether or not we are going to get more disinformation, fake videos, fake audio, et cetera, and that this now becomes all much easier to create with artificial intelligence, and that therefore, as it were, the concern about social media has been ramped up by this. Now, what does history tell us, Kate, about how we react to the introduction of new technology? So I'm thinking of in the 1930s, we started to have radio. And then in the 1950s, we had television. And then more recently, we've had social media. What does history suggest about previous panics about the introduction of new technologies and new forms of communication so far as election campaigns are concerned?
So we have a tendency every single time a new technology comes on to go into moral panic. You know, you can just go back through. My favourite example is when the envelope was introduced in ancient Egypt. There was a huge panic about the fact that suddenly you weren't going to be able to see what people were writing to one another, and that was, you know, a real negative thing for society. So this is not a new tendency. We are afraid of the unknown. And in a situation where you have a new technology come in, it's really unclear what impact it's going to have, especially when it's very easily accessible, it's kind of changing the rules of the game. We tend to really, really worry about it. And quite often, 5 years down the line, once the academic research comes out, we kind of go, oh, do you know what? Actually, it wasn't as bad as we all feared it was going to be. And we keep going through this cycle and we never seem to learn to actually tone down that initial panic and concern. Now, why I think that matters is there's been some really interesting research recently. There's a new paper by an academic in Germany called Andreas Junger, who looked at alarmist warnings about disinformation. So if kind of journalists are saying that, you know, disinformation is going to destroy democracy, then they actually found that people who received and that kind of news had like lower democratic satisfaction, and they kind of perceived a higher threat to society. So it's kind of how we talk about technology and its impact has as much of an impact as the actual technology does. So it's really important, I think, to kind of be quite careful about how we articulate concern.
Some of the first academic research into voting behaviour was the concern about the impact of radio. And that basically said, doesn't really have that much impact. We had research here in the 60s and 70s about the impact of television on election campaigns. And again, it didn't suggest much in the way of a negative impact. Of course, we will wait to see more research on social media. But in a sense, given what you said earlier about don't overemphasize the ability of any kind of campaigning through whatever mechanism or whatever medium to actually persuade people, as opposed to perhaps to be able to get them out. And I guess in the end, given that social media is often people of like minds talking to other people of similar minds, that while it might help to mobilize people, it's probably not going to prove to be that effective at a form of persuasion. And you quoted earlier data saying, you know, 0.7%. So it's all of a piece.
There is, I suppose, a slight distinction between whether artificial intelligence transforms the fortunes of a political party in an election campaign and what I think is often behind the discussion and fear of some politicians, which is that they personally will have their voice mocked up, appear to be saying things that might cause, with a relatively small number of people, a huge furore, but that puts them in danger, it changes how they interact. So is there a reasonable distinction between the impact of this technology on an election campaign and its impact on politicians?
Yeah, I think this is why it's really, really important to kind of pick apart what are we talking about when we think about AI and its threats. So what I would suggest is that AI use by political parties is likely to be very minimal at this election. They're really risk-averse organisations and they take a long time to learn new technologies. So I don't think we'll see them using AI. So this kind of raises so if AI is present, it's likely to be used by other external actors. And this is where the kind of concern starts to come in. Now, it is a lot easier to use AI tools than it was ever before. And they can be used to create images and kind of examples that I've seen, you know, relatively realistic images of politicians. You know, it's particularly easy to make images of Sadiq Khan because there's so many high quality pictures of him. And I do think that does pose questions about whether we are going to see nefarious practices. Now, this is kind of where the unknown comes in. Because our mind kind of tends to go to, right, people are going to be creating these deep fakes. We've already seen examples of them. I would probably suggest that for the most part, we're likely to see AI used to kind of make memes and humorous content of politicians. And indeed, there have kind of been some academics who've been looking at that and have found evidence that, you know, they're used in a kind of humorous way rather than in an attacking way for democracy. But there will be the odd instance where someone does make a deep fake. And that is concerning. So what do we do about that? That's the challenge we're wrangling with at the minute. And I think the responses that have happened so far is that some AI platforms have put constraints in place so that you can't input prompts around politicians. And we've also seen some platforms trying to de-amplify this kind of content so that it won't be seen by a lot of people. The trouble with this is that AI is a really hot topic at the minute, and it's a really easy way to get a story. So every time there have been instances of this, it's been picked up by media agencies and run rounds around this story about AI being a threat to the election. So it's a very, very small set of practice that is being amplified. And I think we are right to be concerned about that. And for me, that raises questions then about what are our duties in covering this kind of content? And just because it does exist, does that make it newsworthy? And should we be profiling this? Because there are steps in place to try and minimise the exposure of the general public to this kind of content.
In a moment, we're going to talk about the party manifestos. But first, a short break.
Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
It's that time of the year. Your vacation is coming up. You can already hear the beach waves, feel the warm breeze, relax, and think about work. You really, really want it all to work out while you're away. Monday.com gives you and the team that peace of mind. When all work is on one platform and everyone's in sync, things just flow. Wherever you are, tap the banner to go to Monday.com.
So there's one big fixture of the traditional election campaign that we've not talked about yet. And that, of course, are the manifestos that all the parties produce during the election campaign, saying what they're going to do and making all their promises. Now, Rachel, you had some responsibility for the 2019 Conservative election manifesto. So what did you emerge from that experience, and what advice would you give your successors?
This is my cue to be mocked ceaselessly by you for the next 10 minutes, isn't it, John? Well, I suppose the first thing I say, to Kate's point about leaflets, which is not, I think, always understood about manifestos, is that when manifestos are published, almost everything that's in them has already been announced. In most modern election campaigns, there's a grid of announcements that drive your prime minister or leader of the opposition or cabinet ministers around the country with sort of packaged up things that they're promising the electorate and that then go into leaflets. So the manifesto itself comes pretty late in the campaign usually and doesn't tend to say a lot that's new. But I'm quite sure, John, you will also tell me that it doesn't matter anyway.
It's not at the election at which they are published, but rather the election after. Because, you know, all those wonderful words you wrote in 2019, Rachel, are now there to be quoted back at the government as we move into the argument about whether or not the Conservatives have delivered or not. Now, it may be, in fairness, that so much has happened that was nobody could have anticipated since December 2019, that perhaps we will get less of that at this election. But as it were, claiming that the government hasn't delivered, broken its promises, etc., is often a line of opposition attack. And, you know, that manifesto, that handy little document, which has there a statement of all the promises that the incumbent government made, is potentially capable of being used as ammunition in the opposite direction come the next election.
I think it's a very important point, and I don't know, Kate, whether you've done much research on this, but when you're in political campaigns, you broadly think of manifestos as falling into one of two categories. They're either a We Are the Change manifesto, or they're a We Started the Job, Trust Us to Finish It manifesto. And if you look back at different successful election manifestos, they're usually pretty clearly in one of those categories or another. What I think is going to be quite interesting about this election is that the Conservatives don't really have an obvious job they're asking people to trust them to finish, partly, as you say, because lots of things have changed since 2019, and partly because people think that the country's not doing very well. Labour are asking to be the change in terms of not being the Conservatives, but it looks like they're going to be pretty darn cautious on what they say they're going to do instead. So we neither have a change except negatively or a trust us to do the job except negatively. And that's a little bit different from certainly all of the elections I've been involved in, which my first was 2010.
But you don't remember
into these patterns.
You don't remember 1997, Rachel? Yeah.
Well, I just about remember it, but I wasn't.
It's
11,
all very,
so,
you know. The Labour Party then promised to keep to the spending plans of the then incumbent government, even though Ken Clark, the then Chancellor, said I wouldn't have ever kept to those plans if I'd been stayed as Chancellor. And they are doing exactly the same thing now. It's the Blairite playbook. Though it has to be said, and maybe the Labour Party would want to note, that if you actually go through the record of our election campaigns, that actually the Labour campaign in the 1997 election was actually the least successful in terms of the party hanging on to its share of the vote. Owen, which have been the most successful campaigns in increasing Labour's share of the vote? Actually, it was the two campaigns headed up by Jeremy Corbyn. Though, of course, Jeremy Corbyn was starting from a very low base and Tony Blair was starting from a high base. So in a sense, the damage of Jeremy Corbyn was done beforehand and the Tony Blair had done his work in advance. But just to remind ourselves that things aren't always quite what you might imagine.
There is one other thing I looked at, and Kate, I don't know how much research you've done on manifestos, but there was a fascinating little paper that looked at the word count of manifestos over the last 120 years. And in 1900, I don't know if you both know this, but I didn't, the Labour manifesto was 150 words long. And I read it. It was a sort of series of just statements of things that were going to be different. So no compulsory vaccination. I don't know what vaccination they were saying should not be compulsory. Adequate maintenance for children. It was just sort of a list of statements. They failed at this election, obviously. That they asked people to vote for. And there's been this inexorable increase in the size of manifestos over the last 120 years. And we're now hitting sort of heading towards 200,000 words in our manifestos. They become these huge rhetorical devices with lots of promises and lots of areas in them in a way that was certainly wasn't true 100 years ago, but wasn't even true 50 years ago. They've sort of bloated ever more. And my assumption has always been that that was partly because of the medium, that because you're not printing these on paper anymore, or they're usually digital, so you don't care how long they are. There's lots more images. You're using them in different ways, that kind of pushes you towards them being bigger. But from what Kate was saying earlier, maybe that's not true. Maybe we're just less disciplined than we used to be.
I think that's a really interesting thought. I almost wonder if there's something about a shift in how manifestos are used in campaigning as well, because I don't think that anyone intends or expects voters to read these manifestos anymore. And almost they become so long, you know, the job of actually going through them is getting harder and harder to kind of work out what are the kind of key pledges, what are the key lines that are there. And, you know, maybe that's a deliberate tactic. Maybe I'm becoming cynical. But, you know, it's very, very easy to kind of nail a party on have they delivered on their record when it's a 10-page document. It's much harder to work out what all those pledges are and monitor progress on a 300-page document.
But I think that manifestos also play an important role in, as it were, the conversation between politicians and the press. The press do tend to read them. They tend to look at them in quite detail, and they're looking for flaws, weaknesses, etc., etc. So in a sense, we get a conversation between journalists and politicians, where the result of which voters won't be following detail of it, but occasionally journalists uncover something which causes difficulty. And the most obvious, famous, recent example of that, of course, is Theresa May's attempt, contrary to Rachel's normal practice, of writing a policy for social care at the last minute before 2017, and then it unravelling so far as the journalistic reaction was concerned. Theresa May famously said nothing has changed, when, of course, she clearly had done a reverse. So, and that, of course, in a sense, that sends a signal to voters in terms of, well, does what these parties say make sense? And they might pick that up as a result of this conversation. But otherwise, it really is, as it were, the political elite talking to the political elite about the possible details of public policy.
And that was certainly, you know, my experience, two things that happened and apparently always happen in these campaigns. The first is everyone starts by saying they really want a short manifesto and then adds lots of things to it. And the other is you are very, very worried, not even in a grand sense, so not even something as big as the social care policy, but in a minor sense about negative news stories that you could avoid. So there was plenty of time in the 2019 campaign where we were pressing, you know, control F to check that we'd used the word veterans as often as 2017 and 2015 had, and that we use the word women enough, and just all of which are, as you say, John, about an interplay between politics and the political media. particularly the print political media, actually, rather than an assumption that the voters particularly care. I'm not convinced that that is good for election campaigns or the period after, but it does seem to be an inexorable force.
Kate, thank you very much indeed for your insight. And I think you've helped to challenge some of the myths that are already being created about the 2024 election.
Thank you so much.
That's it from Trendy for this week. I'm John Curtis.
And I'm Rachel Wolf. Thank you for listening, and we'll be back next week.
Tortoise.
Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much, but when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.